Mr. Martin, Reel 6. Now, we'd got to the point where you joined, I think, one troop, B Squadron, of the 2nd Lothian and Border Horse, to Robertville, near Philippeville. And we were talking about some of the officers. We talked about the colonel and the company commander, Major Anthony the Grey. Any other key officers of that you recall at the time? Or NCOs?
Well, Anthony the Grey was a Coltrane guardsman, and he was there for battle experience, hopefully to form, at a later date, a guard army division. Now, there was a Captain Johnson. He was a senior officer. He'd been awarded the MC in Africa, and he, although we weren't too well aware of it at the time, he was an Italian linguist, and they did start classes, and obviously everybody said, oh, well, we must be going to Burma if we started Italian classes. And we did actually end up in Italy. But more about his conversation with the farmers later. I took over from a young chap, I think his name was Magner, as far as I can remember. And I don't know why, but he wanted to get out of the Lothians. I don't know whether he wanted to get into infantry, but he certainly wanted to get out. And I took his position as troop leader of one troop. There was a Ted Ball, who was a two troop commander, and a chap named Waterston, who was three troop commander. Alan is still around, and when the war finished, he kept on with the territorial in Edinburgh and later became the colonel of the post-war regiment. And Alan had done quite a lot in North Africa, and had seen quite a lot of active service with them. And they were the main ones in the squadron that I can remember. As far as the troop was concerned, I was fortunate in many respects in that, in the main, the troop remained the same right through the campaign, but apart from one or two casualties and one or two promotions. I had a very good wireless operator. Sadly, he was taken from me just before the Battle of Casino, and the substitute was put in his place. They wanted him in squadron headquarters.
What about your troop NCOs? Who were they at the time?
There was one who was called the Gnat. He was so small, but he was a corporal. Wellsford. He was a very good chap, actually. Very good chap. There was a Sergeant Wilson. He was the troop sergeant. He unfortunately had a bit of a rough time in North Africa, and he was inclined to suffer from being a little bit bomb happy in heavy shelling occasions.
We'll come to that, yes.
He was a troop sergeant under Corporal Wellsford of the 2nd.
Were they helpful to you? Because they'd obviously got a lot more experience than
they
you
were
had.
Completely experienced in battle, and they were both very helpful indeed. They were. I think Corporal Wellsford went out of his way to help me as a newcomer to the troop, and he put me wise to the members of the troop individually as to the characteristics of them and any problems there had been. And the main object from then on was to get to know my troop as a newcomer. Bear in mind, they'd all been in action before. And it was my job to get their confidence and to speak to them and get to know them inside out, as it were.
How did you go about that?
Well, we did troop training, and I made it my business to make sure that they were content in what they had got to do and their conditions in the situation which we found ourselves. An example.
Hang on a minute, before you go to the example, because we best start with the tank you had first. What tank were you equipped with?
We had Shermans.
Now, could you give me a complete description of the Sherman, as far as you can remember,
yes,
and what everybody did in the crew, and the crew name members you had, but yes, starting with the Sherman itself.
Yes, the Sherman itself. These were just coming in, actually. They had some during the Italian African campaign, but they required more. And one or on one occasion only, pardon me, I went to Bone with some members of the troop to collect a couple of tanks. These we brought back. Now, the Sherman itself, pardon me, was, to my way of thinking, like a tower compared with the Valentines and Crusaders and Covenanters, which I'd been in before. I didn't like the height of it. It was a first-class tower for enemy gunners. As a tank, mechanically, I found it very efficient. We had diesel engine variety to begin with. And these, I found, were very roll-worthy. They were very good, very reliable. The gun, I thought, without my experience, I have no experience, but I considered it to be quite useless against the German 88s and 75, long 75. It was a short gun, and it was, to my way of thinking, excellent for high explosive work against infantry and artillery. But against tanks, it had little muzzle velocity. Now, to compensate for that, we were issued with what was known as a sabot ammunition at a later date. This was a combined shell in which the outer case flew off when it left the muzzle of the gun, and it boosted its velocity at least double. And this was to be used only in emergency cases if we met tigers.
But you got that later?
We got those later, okay, yes. Right. But I remember that as a main feature of the tank because I didn't like the short gun. The tank itself, you had a five-man crew in which you had a driver and co-driver. Atwood was my driver to begin with. And a young fellow by the name of Page. Atwood came from Derby. Page was a Londoner. And Page was not the chatty type, but he was a good man, and he would do whatever was required. My turret crew was a young chap by the name of Dance. He was a gunner. He was a cockney, and he was quite a character. He was a good gunner, very alert. And my loader was a chap named Brunt.
That'd be the wireless operator as well.
The wireless operator and loader, yes. He was a good wireless operator, and he was a very calm individual. Didn't say a great deal. He just sat there smoking. He smoked his own cigarettes and mine as well. And it amused me when I used to see him tipping his ash into a little box that he'd fastened to the turret ring. Most meticulous, cigarette ash into this wooden box. The floor was filthy, and never seemed to bother at all, even though it was most meticulous with his cigarette ash. But that was my crew. I never closed down except on one occasion when the Germans used air bursts and we crossed the river.
Now, what exactly did the driver do then?
Well, the driver was responsible for getting you from A to B. I remember in battle they were closed down. He was responsible for getting you from A to B. He relied on my instructions as to where to go. He had a limited field of view because he only had a periscope, which was movable. He could see left and right by moving it. But with hands on the sticks, he hadn't got a great deal of opportunity to move it. So he relied on me guiding him to the bush ahead, to the left of that, to the right of that, and so on.
They wouldn't sit up. Was the seat up and was the head out of the...
Not in battle, no. Oh, no, then it closed down completely in battle because it would only need a machine gun bullet and it's gone. And they sprayed the tanks with machine guns and with high explosive as well. Because whatever the tank appeared, all the artillery would put to bear on it.
So he did that. What about the co-driver?
The co-driver had a machine gun in front of him. He was a second driver. We always reckoned that the second driver was not quite up to the standard of the first one, but in an approach march, if we were going to a battle area, or if we were moving from one sector to another, sometimes the second driver took over to give the first driver a break so that he would be fresh for the battle. That was what the procedure we used, or certainly I used. My second driver was a very good chap. Now, I could think of others who weren't so good. They were not as, what should we say, meticulous with the movement of the tank, getting in between objects. One chap I remember in my own troop, he went, we were passing a line of vehicles, all had got camouflage nets off, waiting for the battle, and this chap went so close to it, and he took the camouflage nets off some of the vehicles, which didn't please who were looking after them.
And he had the hull gun as well, machine gun.
He had a machine gun in front of him, so that if in the case of infantry, he could use a machine gun on the infantry.
And that was a Browning?
That was a Browning, and there were about every five rounds was a tracer, so that he could see where it was going. That was the only way he got an idea as to where the shots were going. Turret crew,
Hang on. How did the body of the tank, how did they get out of the tank in the event of...
Well, there were two exits. The two drivers have a hatch each. If the gun happened to be over one, then the other escape hatch was on the floor. That was only accessible should there be space underneath the tank. Now, in wet earth and so on, you would very often find that you couldn't get out of that way. And they would have to try and climb out through the other driver's hatch if they could get across to it, which they were able to because they were usually athletic young chaps and they were not awfully big. If you were a big chap, then it was just too bad. That was their form of exit, and they entered in the same way, of course.
Now, in the turret, what did the gunner, what was his role?
The gunner sat right in front of me where I stood at the back. The gunner's role was to carry out orders to traverse left or right to the target, which I would give him. Sometimes he could see the target himself, but if not, I would get him onto the target, and once he found it, then he got his gun onto it, and I would give him the range to fire from.
Did he traverse the turret, or could you do it as well?
No, I couldn't do it at all. He had got it traversed. It was an electronic traverse. There was a manual override, but it was electric. I got it. He could travel it completely. He had full control of that. He also had full control of the elevation of the gun to get the range. I have no dealing with that other than giving the instructions. The loader...
He'd have a machine gun as well, a Browning.
A Browning machine gun, yes. But that was in front of the loader. It wasn't in front of the gunner. He had nothing to do with that. He simply got the guns onto the target. And he set the range... and fired as a member.
How did he fire?
He fired from buttons on the floor. They were foot buttons, and his feet, left foot, hovered over them. And he would fire as and when required. And they became quite proficient at pressing the right button.
Did it cause accidental firings?
I've never found it, no. I never found it at all. I was fortunate in that respect. There were never any accidental firing. And mind you, we didn't load until we were on the scene of the battle or where there was likely to be. We never carried a round up the spout, just in case of any accidents. As you referred to it as a round up the spout, you see, that when you loaded the gun. But we never carried a round up the spout unless there was a need for it. And with experience, you realise when there was perhaps a need for one round in the gun.
Now, what about the loader? Now, the wireless operator.
He was a wireless operator.
What was his job on the gun first as a loader?
As a loader, he had got to load the gun. And with the round that he was ordered to load, I would simply say load HE or load AP. And he would load the appropriate round.
Where would he get it from?
Well, there was round the bottom of the turret, there was a ring with holes in it. And that we call that the turret ring. In the centre of the turret, there was a boss, which was the centre pivotal point. I used to stand with one foot on that and one on the turret ring. Now, the turret would revolve, and round the loader, there were rams standing in holes all the way around the turret ring. And from this line of rams, he would lift one, the appropriate armour piercing of HE, and slip it into the breech. And we would then make sure that there was always a supply near where he was, move them along if necessary.
Who would do that?
I would do sometimes, and the gunner would, if we had a moment to spare. You got a supply near him that was adequate to be going on with.
And was there more inside the tank?
Yes,
or
we had
body
ammunition bins. There was one at the side and another one on the other side, and they went in, and you simply pulled them out when your stop ground turret ring was getting there.
How many could you have in the turret ring, roughly?
By memory, I think we were obliged to carry a regulation number. If I remember rightly, it was about 76 to 80.
Would that be in the whole tank, though?
That was in the whole tank, yes.
So how many then would be in the turret?
Probably in the turret ring, about 50 probably.
So most of them?
Yeah, most of them in the turret. We were all accessible, mind you, from the turret. There were panels cut away from the side of the turret so that you simply could pull them out. There was no problem about having to stop and get, you know, things moved away to get the rounds out. They were all readily available. That was one advantage.
Now, what was his role? So he'd operate the breech, would he?
Yes. He simply swung it down, slammed the rope round in, picked it up again, and he was ready to fire. And then he would get another round ready for that one. As soon as that one was gone, another round on his knee. He normally carried one on his knee. And remember, at the same time, he got to listening to the radio, which was on net anyway. But occasionally, if I wanted to contact them, I would switch over onto intercom.
So, did he have to have? Did the gun recoil into the chamber?
It did, yes, quite a recoil.
So he'd have to watch it.
Yeah. Oh well, yes. They were past masters at that, and there was a gun guard on it, so that the gun shot down between the arms of the guard, and they, unless they were misbehaving, they wouldn't get past that guard. They wouldn't put their arm underneath because they knew it was dangerous. But there was a guard on it.
Did they ever remove the guard?
No. Only yes, there were repairs to be done or anything like that. But not under any other circumstances, no.
And so that was his job. What about firing the machine gun? I mean, the gunner fired it. What was the wireless operator loader's responsibility for the machine
gun? His responsibility was to clear stoppages. Occasionally, you'd get one round jamming another one. Then that would have to lift the lid, get the breech block out, clear it, and put it back again. And there were special tools for that, which he had available. And there again, they'd been trained so that they did it automatically.
I believe you could also change the barrel. The barrels on the Browning would go, and you'd have to change them. You could do that from inside the tank.
Yeah, we didn't have any problems like that. We were very fortunate. We had no problems in that period. He would also have to change the belts. You know, you use a belt, and you'd have to change the little buttons. Again, we had a supply of those handy.
In the turret?
Yeah, in the tank, ready.
Now, what about his wireless duties, the other side? So what would he do on the wireless?
Well, he made sure, first thing in the morning, that the wireless set was netted to the frequency given.
Did it change every day?
Most days, yes. There were occasions when we didn't. If we were, for example, on what you might call a rest day, we wouldn't necessarily change it, you see. But if we were moving into action, then we almost certainly would have a different net. And we had a flick frequency so that we could change in the middle of a battle because somebody had picked up our radio frequency. And we'd be told to change net. And that was given by a code word. It was fairly straightforward, actually. And all these were set by the wireless operator in the morning. And we also had a signals group within the squadron who, if there were any problems, would come round each tank and check before we went out.
It sounds like that was his only... The wireless operator didn't do much on the wireless other than set it in the morning.
No, he did no repairs to it.
No, but I mean, he didn't have to control... It was the commander who controlled the wireless.
That's right, yes. I had a switch by the side of me.
And did he have another switch?
There was another switch available, yes.
But it would be you that used it?
I did the main one, yes.
Now, what was the role of the tank commander then, which was the officer, the corporal, and the sergeant, and a another?
Yes. Well, their job was, A, to control their own tank to begin with, to make sure that they carried out the orders given by the officer. And I'll say this, that when we were given orders, in my own case, my first duty, when I was given the orders, I got my crews together, all of them, and told them exactly what we got to do. And I would then, while they were getting organised, I would take the NCO and tell them in more detail what was involved. And if I was knocked out, it was their responsibility to carry on, so that they knew exactly what was going on. That was the main thing. The crew commander's job was to make sure his crew efficiently, know what it's got to do, and you've got to, at the same time, guide the driver. That was a very important part, to make sure that he was going in the direction you wanted him to go. And that applied to the corporal and the sergeant. Normally, we, if the situation allowed it, we fought in arrowhead positions, either in the centre, slightly in advance of the other two, sergeant on the right, corporal on the left. Their responsibility was, apart from looking ahead, was to looking at the flanks. I looked ahead only, unless I could see something on the flank. It was their job to keep an eye on the flanks. I looked ahead only. And, of course, you've got to make sure that you've got sufficient ammunition. And if you were running low on ammunition, it was the loader's job to tell me that we were getting down. And then we would have to retire, if necessary, go back to get ammunition.
Now, how did you use the radio yourself?
Well, you were always listening in to the main set, to the A set, for orders from squadron headquarters. That was the main thing. We always listened in to the A set. I seldom used the B set, quite frankly. Seldom used it, because that was a contact with the two troops, my sergeant and corporal. Only on rare occasions did I have to order one tank to go in a certain direction and will be out of sight. Then I would use it. But normally, we followed a pattern of movement, and they knew exactly what we wanted, and by visual signals, I could get them to go in a certain direction. And I was still listening into my ASAP, because that was most important.
And the ASAP was your link with the
squadron headquarters.
Yes. Could you hear the regimental headquarters on that set as well, or was it just a squadron net?
Squadron headquarters, unless they flicked over to our set, to our frequency. You had in squadron headquarters an officer who contacted regimental headquarters from squadron headquarters. Now, they knew the two frequencies, and they flicked over when they wanted to contact regimental headquarters. And occasionally, I've heard the CO come on to my frequency because he's flicked over. He wanted to speak to our squadron as an independent unit. But that was very rare. It was generally an order that came through squadron headquarters.
Then you could flick to intercom.
I could flick to intercom, yes. That was convenient because they all wore earphones, you see. And I just give them orders on the intercom to do this, that and the other, for loading the gun, for example, as they load HE, and they'd hit it and automatically load it, and the gunner would make sure there was some HE round available for the loader. That was the important thing. And of course, telling the driver what to do, he required the intercom, and I spoke to him on the intercom as to where to go and what to do. In case it happened on one occasion, we were ordered to go down a hill.
Hang on, we will come to
that later. Yeah.
Now, what about your training then? You know, while you were at Robertville, the training exercises, what type of thing were you doing?
Well, we did squadron exercises, we did troop exercises, but we first of all started off by getting used to the tanks. They were new to a lot of us because we'd not been in Sherman before. We have no training in Sherman in this country. When we got there, we were given our tanks. We kept our own particular tanks, and we got used to them. We got used to the noise of them, the mechanism of them, the maneuverability. This was general training to get used to our tank to begin with. Having mastered that and got used to it and its behaviour up and down hills, you go down a wadi and across the bottom and up the other side. The movement of them, the general sort of application of movement and everything. Then we went on to the range. That was the next phase. We fired machine guns. We fired particularly the 75. In the main, armor-piercing shot at some old tanks. Now that was a very important part of the operation. We had to set our own sights so that the shell landed where we'd intended it to land. that was important.
Now, how did you set the sights?
We set the sights. On the end of the muzzle of the gun, there were two little marks, a vertical and horizontal, at right angles to each other. And we fastened a thread vertically and horizontally. Now, by taking the firing pin out from the block, we could see that little cross wire at the end. And we set our guns by going to a position where we could see something which we knew the distance from where we were, maybe 800 yards. We would get the gun on it, we would get our aiming mark in the rangefinder on it, and that was the way we worked. And by setting it and then going to a range and trying it out, we found by trial and error whether it was acting as it ought to do.
And did it?
In the main, yes. In the main, yes. This was a feature when we had any major problems. If we'd done a lot of firing, for example, it would sometimes cause a little bit of a hiccup. So you had to check your sighting from time to time. In the main, we found it worked extremely well. There was another thing that we never did. As you probably know, the Sherman had got the gadget on it that you were supposed to be able to keep on the move and fire. It had kind of compensated a gyroscope so that it kept the gun on the target. Well, it never did, as far as I could see. So we always stopped to fire. It meant that you hit the target then, which was important.
So, did you try the gyroscopic first in practice?
I never tried it. Everybody said that it never... The regimental instruction were that you stopped the fire, that it never worked. That was the opinion. It had been tried, and rather than waste time trying it, we didn't bother. And that normally you fire from a, what you might call, a hold-down position. You very seldom... You might, on an open plain, find that an advantage, but we never had that in Italy. We never had open plains. The nearest we had was a sort of Monte Rotondo just north of Rome. That was reasonably open. But other than that, it was all hills, roads, quite useless. So I never used it. But that was the main thing. Setting the gun sights for accuracy, and then plenty of training with the gun so they got into a habit of firing, and you're exactly where the firing buttons were without looking. They just touched it, and it was a routine, and they were very proficient. And we didn't change the gun with the wireless operator. We didn't. They were masters in their own field, and that was the way it worked efficiently, to my way of thinking.
Now, what about the troop and squadron exercises? What were they like?
Well, once we got over the elementary training, we then started to go into troop movements where we moved across country in the normal positions, were open out, close in, send one off to an angle. That was quite interesting, but there wasn't much fun in just a troop exercise. It became more interesting when you had a squadron working together. And that, of course, required a lot more consideration and planning. And once we got into the troop action, where you knew exactly your position and what you got to do, then we went on to squadron operations. And we would go out onto what was considered to be, well, wasteland, it was open, arid, scrubland. We did squadron exercises there. And you would imagine that there was on a certain hill feature that was occupied, and you would then attack it from various angles. One troop would be given the lead troop, others would go on the flanks. And apart from your objective in the distance there, you've got to watch the ground, because there were all sorts of problems, like little streams that you've got to consider. There might even be little villages, hotments of the natives who were there. So you've got to be rather careful when you do this.